Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman of uncommon intelligence whose perspective, particularly on a part of the battle space in the current phase of this war for the free world, the culture wars, the information wars, if you will, is, well, second to none, is our first guest. She is Dinah West, a regular featured element of this program. She is the author of two superb books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. You can find her writings at the Daily Caller and, of course, at her own site, dinahwest.net. She's always welcome here, but especially at this moment. Dinah, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, wonderful to be back with you.
I'm particularly anxious to talk with you, Dinah, because there's a very hot war underway at the moment in the information battle space, I guess one might say, a political war for sure, involving this issue of the separation of children from people who profess to be their parents coming across our border illegally. And I'm anxious to get your sense as to what's going on, and in particular, the extraordinary focus and intensity of the media echo chamber that is accompanying all of this and greatly amplifying it. Your thoughts?
Well, this is not a political debate. It's not an exchange of ideas or an effort to shed light and facts on a difficult political issue. This is a war not for our minds. I think it's a war for our emotions. And this is why it's so terribly dangerous, because you have these images. You have this notion that Donald Trump is separating children from their parents. But what we're really looking at is an assault on the law, on the border, on the election of Donald Trump, on this very issue of restoring our border. And this is why you see this crescendo, this intensity, because if he prevails, his presidency is a success. And this is the last thing that the left wants. But it's more than a cultural war. I mean, we're looking at insurrectionary activities in our own capital. We had last night the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Kirstjen Nielsen, at dinner at a restaurant being chased out by Democratic Socialists of America, the Antifa unleashed on a cabinet member, and nothing happened. I mean, and it was over the border, I should add. I mean, this is the level at which we're at. It is chaotic, and it is, again, emotional, but it is all about destroying law, order, borders, and Trump.
And not necessarily in that order, but certainly all of those are elements of it. And Dinah, I guess the other piece of it that is, of course, worrying is the extent to which there are growing numbers of Republicans who are now throwing in with the Democratic narrative on this, and the Democratic Socialists, and who knows who all else resist, Antifa. Again, what do we make of that? Is this marking a wholesale abandonment by the elected elite of Donald Trump and perhaps, at least in the case of these Republicans, their base?
Well, once again, I mean, this is nothing new. This is where they are. This is who they are. I think what you're seeing is they are sensing that they can catch this wave of intensity and do what they wanted to do right from the moment Donald Trump announced his presidential election on this very issue, protecting our border, restoring our own immigration policy in the interest of this country. Sovereignty. These are the issues that we can call them uniparty, the elite, the swamp. These are the issues they abhor. This is what they are. This is their mission is to advance what people think of as the globalist project. It is against sovereignty, it is against the nation, it is against the borders, and they sense a kill point, and they're driving as hard as they can on it. Because if Donald Trump abandons his promises and caves to this, he is done, because his extremely enthusiastic patriotic supporters will be tremendously betrayed and disappointed. So they sense that, and that's why they're throwing everything at this. It's absolutely a flashpoint in American history.
Right. And of course, it's accompanied by this related issue of amnesty for illegal aliens, children who came here with their parents, according to the meme, who have now, in many cases, become quite aged, but they're still nonetheless treated as the DACA kids. We'll be watching that closely, as I know will you, Dinah, and we'll talk more about it next week when the dust settles, I pray, without an amnesty being approved by the Republican Congress. Let me ask you, there are two items that are actually good news that we don't often get to share this program, but I know that you particularly will appreciate both of them. Let's talk quickly about the settlement by the Southern Poverty Law Center of what was a threatened suit to the tune of $3.375 million. What did you make of that, Diana? And what does it suggest about this so-called SPLC?
My take on this does have a lot to do with my own study of the beneficiary, Majid Nawaz, who is not what I would consider any kind of a truth teller about Islam or jihad. And so in a sense, there is a strange justice here in that his award for being aligned with truth tellers on Islam, which of course is the target of the SPLC, was actually inappropriate. So there's a funny way to look at it in the sense that he is now funded to continue his own efforts at what I would call taqiyya in terms of taking our eyes and understanding off of Islam and going on to the violent extremism narrative, which is where his heart and soul is, as we've seen time and again. It's kind of an interesting moment, but I don't actually see it as any particular vindication, given that so many people are still tarred and feathered by their smears and slander, who are truth tellers.
Let me just give you a slightly different cut at this. I take your point. I think that the Quilliam Foundation and Majid Nawaz, the fellow who got this settlement, were wrongly identified by the SPLC when they're actually playing for the same team, more or less. But the point is that the SPLC did have to acknowledge that it gets the facts wrong. This is the latest and the most expensive of several episodes in which they've had to recant some of their findings about haters and bigots and so on. And they have smeared you, they have smeared me, they've smeared many of our friends, and they haven't been the least bit contrite about that. But I do think that what's important here is that there is an admission that they are not a trustworthy, reliable outfit. And I hope that every corporation and service provider and Wikipedia outlet and the like that has taken them as a reliable source is going to disassociate themselves from it. And quickly, very, very quickly, Diana, the president's team have announced that they're withdrawing from the UN Human Rights Council. Your take on that?
Absolutely fantastic. And so interesting in that people will tell you over many decades that such an action is impossible, that you can't walk away from these kinds of international organizations. Well, actually, here we see Donald Trump once again breaking the mold. And I would hope that the next stop is to walk away from the UN entirely and get it out of this country.
Diana, we heed your advice and look forward to it with you next week as well. Thank you so much for your time today.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are joined by Kevin Freeman, a man we have the privilege of consulting with each week, renowned for his expertise as an economic maven, specifically with expertise on matters involving economic warfare. He writes a blog called globaleconomicwarfare.com, and he is the driving force behind a new television product, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, the author of two best-selling books on these subjects, Secret Weapon, How Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again, and Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. Kevin Freeman, it's good to have you back in the house. Welcome.
Great. Thank you, Frank.
Well, speaking of the stock market, it seems to be off considerably at the moment, as we're speaking at least. As a result, we're told of the ratcheting up of the trade war between the United States and China. You're thinking currently, Kevin, as to what Donald Trump is doing and where this is likely to lead.
President Trump is waking up to reality. I believe he's been awake based on his campaign and everything else, but he's waking the rest of us up to reality. Two decades ago, we allowed China to enter the World Trade Organization. We offered them most favored nation status. We gave them all sorts of special deals that they could sell goods and services they produced here in America, but did not reciprocate. They did not allow us to sell into their markets. And we allowed that because there was this naive belief that, well, if we do more trade, then they'll become more friendly, they'll become more democratic, they'll become more open as a society and so forth. And that's not been the case. They've taken advantage of it, used it to build a world-class economy that rivals ours, and they've been operating under unrestricted warfare really since the book was written in 1999.
Yeah, if not before. Kevin, let me ask you about several other pieces of the China story that are in the battle space that you monitor so closely at the moment. Talk to us about the efforts that the Chinese are evidently making to rewrite the rules of the internet, something that is described in Sam Sachs in an article in The Atlantic at the moment.
Well, it's a tremendous article. It is eye-opening. Actually, you and I have talked about this quite a bit on your radio program. There was an effort to remove the naming right organization from U.S. control, which is ICANN, and they were successful in doing that. And it is now under international control. The bottom line of this is that China wants to replace. We invented the internet as a nation, I guess Al Gore in specific, but the nation. And I say that tongue in cheek. Yes, I say that tongue in cheek. But as a nation, we invented the internet. We've exported it to the world, and we have some levels of controls left, requiring openness and so forth. And the Chinese don't like it. They want it not under American control, and they're offering to set up alternatives in just about every respect. And this is a part of their ongoing efforts to de-Americanize the world, to put things under Chinese control. They're building equipment that operates much of the infrastructure, and who knows what kind of nefarious backdoors it has. They're wanting control over naming rights. They're literally attempting to turn China into the world's cyber superpower, not one of, but the cyber superpower. And it's got horrible implications for freedoms of speech and freedoms of exchange and everything else. And if they are successful and they no longer need America for the internet, they will have removed one more prop under what protects the U.S. as a world superpower.
And with very far-reaching implications, needless to say, given the dependence of really every aspect of our society, to say nothing of our economy and our security on the internet these days. Speaking of the Chinese backdoors, I want to get your thoughts on the Senate's rejection of the deal the president has fashioned with ZTE, one of those Chinese telecommunications mega companies that has been putting in, we believe, backdoors and otherwise engaging in nefarious aspects of telecommunications infrastructure in this country and elsewhere. What are your thoughts, Kevin Freeman?
Well, ZTE and Huawei both, and frankly, any Chinese company that is started by or operated by former members of the People's Liberation Army should be suspect. But they both have a history of violating sanctions or putting in backdoors or other things. And this is a serious threat because if our if our infrastructure becomes dependent on Chinese-made equipment, if our fighter jets, if our telecommunication systems, our satellites, And in large part, they are dependent on Chinese chips and Chinese hardware of some type, then we're vulnerable to them turning the switch. And the Chinese understand this. That's why they have this new policy in China that everything has to be made in China to be offered. And anything we sell in China, we have to give them our architecture to. This is a part of how they've stolen our intellectual property for years, and they put us in a position of vulnerability where they could literally flip a switch and darken parts of America.
Among other things, by going after our electric grid, I think you're speaking of there. Kevin, in addition to the cyberspace domain in which the Chinese are seeking to de-Americanize the world, we also have space as another domain in which that seems to be afoot. Talk a little bit, if you would, about what we know of China's efforts to exercise basically dominion over space and the importance that we all should attach to what President Trump announced yesterday was to be a major new initiative of his administration to create a space force.
Well, the future of our economy in large part will be determined by who controls space. The cost of sending up a payload in a reusable rocket is a fraction. My friend Rod Martin has compared it. He said, if the difference between the current methodology in space is like buying the 747, when you have reusable rockets, it's like buying a seat on the 747 because the cost per payload drops so very dramatically, which means that you can mine asteroids, which have trillions of dollars worth of raw materials and precious metals and so forth. It means you can control satellite and communications. It means whoever dominates space dominates the Earth. And it really is the final frontier in that respect. And billionaires like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and others have seen that. So they've all got initiatives to do that. If you're able to conquer space or control space, you can send a rocket up and land an army in London in a matter of minutes, not a matter of hours. It changes everything, militarily, economically, politically. Everything is changed by whoever controls space. And so China has been aggressive in this fashion. In fact, the Chinese have been offering, as a part of their Belt and Road Initiative, they'll go into a nation in Africa or Asia, and they'll say, we will build this infrastructure, but we'll also give you a series of satellites that we build in China that they no doubt have some level of control over or ability to spy through. And we'll give you these as a part of the infrastructure package. And so they're literally spacifying the rest of the world under their control. And that's a very, very frightening thought. So President Trump's initiative is a good first step, but we have a long road to go. There will be a space war, and we better get started on it.
Yeah. Again, I think it's kind of like a trade war. It's underway, albeit in a maybe Cold War phase at the moment. But the kinds of capacities that China is putting into place to exercise, as I say, control over what goes on in space and perhaps even access to it is very, very alarming indeed and needs to be addressed. I think the Space Force, as you say, is an important first step. It needs to be backed up by the wherewithal to exercise once again our domination of that important battle space. Hey, Kevin, one other piece of what China's up to caught my eye. It has not gotten a lot of attention yet, I don't think, but it's troubling. We've seen successive administrations in this country essentially being coerced into bribing governments to try to pay essentially ransom in one form or another for Americans that have been simply held hostage. This has been done in Iran, of course. This has been done in North Korea, of course, and to varying degrees elsewhere. But now it seems it's taking place in communist China. What is up with that? And what should our response be, as you see it?
Well, the Chinese have instituted exit bans. If you are in any way an enemy of the state, you're not allowed to travel. They have this facial recognition technology, and they've combined it with a social credit score for their own citizens. So they can see instantly recognize someone, and they can pick you out of a crowd of 100,000 in a matter of seconds. And you go to the airport, you go to a bus station, you want to exit or go somewhere, and they say, no, there's a ban on you. You're not allowed to travel. Well, it's been applied to some U.S. citizens, and they may not even know it because the ban is instituted, but you don't realize it until you show up at the airport to try and leave. They're using it as leverage. They want to control, first off, they want to force the United States to send back people that they feel are hostile to China, even if they're American citizens. They want to require that they be returned to China, and then they want to control the travel inside China, including of American citizens. And this is a means of forcing the American government to do what the Chinese government wants.
A very important new wrinkle in a complex relationship. Kevin Freeman, as always, your insights into the kinds of challenges that we're facing, particularly in the economic warfare space, is invaluable, and we're always appreciative of your time. Thank you, as well as for being a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, of which we're very proud. Congratulations again on Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. And folks, check out globaleconomicwarfare.com and Secret Weapon and Game Plan. Kevin, we'll talk with you again next week.
Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by one of our friends and colleagues who has performed just brilliantly over a very long period of time, both in government service and as a man very much influential outside of government as well, an accomplished author, a regular commentator on this program and others. You have probably seen him appear twice, once in a reprise performance, but twice on Mark Levin's program on Fox News, talking about a subject in which he is one of the country's foremost experts, the threat to our electric grid posed by, among other things, electromagnetic pulse. His name, of course, is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. These days, he is the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. He has been a driving force behind, and in fact, most recently, the staff director of the Congressional Electromagnetic Pulse Threat Commission, and has served in other capacities as well, including for some 20 years or so as a member of the staff of the Central Intelligence Agency, the House Armed Services Committee, and also the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission. A man of many, many parts. I could go on. Let me suffice it to say, he is the author most recently of Apocalypse Unknown, The Struggle to Protect America from Electromagnetic Pulse Catastrophe and Electric Armageddon. Peter Pry, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you back.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
I wanted to talk with you about a couple of things, Peter, very much related to the various subjects and experiences that you've had over the years. But I thought we might start with a topic that I think you were as impressed by as I was in terms of the initiative that the president took earlier this week to unveil a new space force in the United States military. Tell us a little bit about the reason for doing so and the significance that you think this action might have for our security and, for that matter, our economic well-being as well.
Well, base is the high frontier and our assets in space and the ability of the potential adversaries, including North Korea, to threaten us from space are vital interests to this country, vital interests in terms of sustaining our status as a military superpower, because our ability to prevail on the battlefield is heavily dependent on space assets, so dependent that were we to lose them, we would cease to be a military superpower as we are today. Our economy also depends vitally upon our space assets. And the biggest, worst threats to this country comes from space in the form of electromagnetic pulse attack. It's an effect that's generated in our outer space. And the kinds of space weapons that Russia, for example, is talking about bringing back in its Satan II heavy ICBM, and that North Korea already has, imitating an earlier secret weapon from Russia called the Fractional Orbital Bombardment System, is a space weapon. So we need a space force to address these threats. Part of the reason for that, too, has to do with, unfortunately, with the bureaucratic politics within the Department of Defense that has neglected our space assets and has been neglecting the EMP threat. You know, to put it simply, the existing military services that we have, you know, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the people who are in the Joint Chiefs of Staff are from one of these services. They care about infantry, they care about armor, they care about aircraft carriers and airplanes.
Yeah, we mustn't forget the Marines and the Coast Guard. I think they fit into the mix as well. Yeah. They all have their parochial interests.
That's right. And their ability to do their jobs none of them would be effective without space. But none of them are space experts. They've got a space command, you know, but it's subordinate to their services. And so our space assets have not received the kind of priority, and the kinds of threats we face from space haven't received the kind of priority from any of these services. And so it was necessary for the president, and I think an act of great courage, you know, because the Pentagon opposed this, as they always oppose. I mean, the Pentagon was opposed to establishing the Air Force, you may recall. It was the Air Force used to belong to the U.S. Army in World War II, and it only came into its own, you know, in a big way. And the U.S. Air Force is what it is today because it was stood up as a separate service. And we need to do the same thing for space. The fact of the matter is that the interests of the Air Force are so broad that the space interests, you know, become an orphan and have been neglected.
Let's just drill down on a couple of pieces of this, Peter Pry. One is that there are a host of assets that the United States operates in space, some of them military or intelligence related, some of them commercial. We rely upon them for both our national security and for our economy, for our civilization, I guess it's fair to say these days. It seems, Peter, as though very little thought has been given, at the very least, to the commercial side of that asset inventory, and arguably at least some of the military side as well, to making these assets resilient, even in the face of growing evidence that there are nations around the world, the Russians, the Chinese, most prominent among them, but still others emerging, to be able to intercept, perhaps even destroy these assets upon which we rely so heavily. Talk us through how it is that the military, the Air Force, whatever, the Pentagon, has not seen this as a very, very serious threat to their operations as well as their missions.
Well, you're right. The Russians, the Chinese have very aggressive programs to go after U.S. space assets by lasers, by robotized anti-satellite devices, and by nuclear plants that includes the high-altitude burst of a nuclear weapon, which would be the most effective way of taking out space assets at a single blow. You know, you and I were talking earlier about this new 100-megaton warhead that the Russians are going to deploy on a robotic submarine, and about how that might conceal the real purpose, you know, which could be to go after space assets. You know, it would be an ideal weapon for both sweeping the heavens of our satellites and for EMP attack in the United States. How is it that our military, while they're aware of all these programs, have not been motivated to do what's necessary? I think it's because of what we were describing before. You know, because the rice bowl that the Air Force is most interested in is bombers and fighters. You know, because the Air Force is dominated by pilots and people who think in those terms. And you can go through each of the services, and their rice bowl is in ships or in tanks and infantry. And while all of them are critically dependent upon space assets, you know, none of them wants to invest the time, resources, and give the prominence within their own service, you know, to people who are experts in space and care most about that. I think another good metaphor, we were talking about the Air Force, being part of the U.S. Army, and then really coming into its own in a big way after World War II. Well, another example of that is in the Navy. You know, today, the aircraft carrier is the crown jewel of the Navy, and the Navy fights like hell to get as much money as it can for aircraft carriers. But there was a time before World War II when the Navy didn't want aircraft carriers, and it was in love with the battleship. And the only reason they ended up getting aircraft carriers, despite the fact of a visionary Captain Billy Mitchell, who proved that aircraft carriers were the wave of the future, and that aircraft carriers, whoever dominated the air, naval air, was going to dominate naval warfare in the future. Despite the fact that he proved that, the Navy still wouldn't listen. And it was only because we had another visionary, a guy named Carl Vinson, who at the time was the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, who forced the Navy to buy and build aircraft carriers, which is why we had them in the beginning of World War II. And had we not had them, it would have been, well, we probably would have lost the Pacific War. I think the situation today is analogous to that.
In terms of space, let's then turn to the solution that the president has seemingly embraced. And I say seemingly because it's a little unclear exactly what he has in mind. But it seems to be teeing up to be a separate service, a new space force. And Peter Pry, just quickly walk us through, knowing the Pentagon as you do, knowing the bureaucracy, knowing the kind of rice bowls that will be affected by this, describe what we as citizens need to be saying and doing with our elected officials to try to make sure that this critical, yawning problem of space dominance is properly addressed, not just by a new command, but by a well-resourced, well-staffed, and visionary sort of new service in our military.
Yes, exactly. We already have a space command, and it hasn't been enough, you know, because space command is subordinate to STRATCOM, which is subordinate to the Air Force. And thereby we have this, you know, neglected orphan phenomena happening. That's why we don't need another command or even an expanded, strengthened version of Space Command. But what the authors of this had in mind, who have been appealing the members of Congress, who have been appealing President Trump, is for a standalone, separate service, just the way the U.S. Air Force was brought into being after World War II to become a separate service.
And how would this help with the problem that you've described so well here, Peter, of actually maintaining our equities in space, being able to project power from there as the dominant space power, and not least protecting the country against electromagnetic pulse?
Well, there's the boring solution, which is nonetheless vitally important. The bureaucratic politics of it is that it would finally put people who care about space, you know, with their own service, so they would be willing to fight like hell for what we need in space to protect this country's national interests. And that isn't what we have right now. You know, Space Command, as I said, is subordinate to STRATCOM, and that's subordinate to the U.S. Air Force. And these guys basically do what their masters tell them to do in the Air Force at the end of the day. They might fight back a little bit, but their careers are dependent in the end of the day in keeping the Air Force happy. If they're in Space Command, you know, their careers will be dependent on doing the best they possibly can, and they can fight on equal terms with the Air Force and the Army and the Navy and the Marines for the resources they need.
We are hard out of time. This is an extraordinarily important insight. Thank you for your time today, Peter Pry, as well as your work for the Central Intelligence Agency on Capitol Hill, and most especially for your leadership on the Congressional Electromagnetic Pulse Commission.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I am always pleased when we have a chance to take aboard the intelligence of a man who has it in copious quantities. He is Hans von Spakovsky, one of the leading lights at the Heritage Foundation's Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, a man who has spent considerable time in government service, notably as a counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights and as a member of the Federal Election Commission. He has also most recently served on the president's investigatory effort at election fraud. Unfortunately, a short-lived affair, but one to which he has contributed significantly, among other things, through his writings on the subject, Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk. He's also the author of Obama's Enforcer, Eric Holder's Justice Department. Hans von Plaskowski, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Well, thanks for having me back.
I wanted to start, Hans, with your takeaway from the fulminations on Capitol Hill and elsewhere in the aftermath of this investigation by the Inspector General, the report thereon that was released this week. He came to the conclusion, which many of us found somewhat extraordinary, that there was no evidence of political bias, despite what seems to be a report filled with such evidence. What did you make of that?
Oh, it's one of those the glass is half empty or half full kind of things. What I mean by that is, you're right, the almost 600-page report is permeated with bias and political partisanship evidenced by the FBI agents, FBI leadership involved. In fact, the IG says at one point, and this is a quote, that they demonstrated extremely poor judgment and a gross lack of professionalism, that the conduct cast a cloud over the FBI's investigation and sowed doubt over the FBI's work and handling of the investigation. But then he says, well, yeah, but there's no demonstrable evidence it affected the investigation. Well, the IG reminds me of a prosecutor who refuses to prosecute a defendant who was found standing over a dead body with a smoking pistol in his hand because he says, well, nobody actually saw him pull the trigger. And in this case, what does he think? That these FBI agents were so dumb that they would say, oh, well, we're not going to do this in this investigation of Hillary Clinton because I want her to win the election. No, they didn't say that. But they intermixed their political views with their discussions about how the investigation and everything was going. I just don't believe it didn't affect it. And in fact, there's all kinds of limitations that the IG report shows that they put on their investigation, limiting the amount of time they would spend on it, giving immunity agreements to witnesses like Hillary Clinton's two top aides when they didn't need to do that. They could have simply subpoenaed them, and not getting, for example, all of the electronic devices that Clinton and other witnesses had. I mean, they limited their investigation in a way that they haven't limited their investigation into the Russia collusion investigation.
When I heard the IG, Michael Horowitz, and Christopher Wray, the new FBI director, queried on these questions, particularly by Democrats, they were all at pains, it seemed, to say, well, this is really just, you know, business as usual. The various considerations that were shown Mrs. Clinton and the and her lawyers and other fact witnesses who were treated in what seemed to me as a layperson, Hans, to be rather extraordinary, to say the least, if not completely unwarranted, were nonetheless described by Michael Horowitz, who most people have described as a straight shooter, as pretty much consistent with standard practice in the FBI or in the Department of Justice. You've spent time in the higher reaches of that department. Is that your assessment as well?
No, it's not, and I'll give you a specific example of what I'm talking about. There's discussion in the IG report about the fact that they gave immunity agreements, for example, to Cheryl Mills, who was a top aide to Hillary Clinton, because Cheryl Mills is a lawyer, and they were afraid, well, if we subpoena the documents, there may be documents protected by attorney-client privilege on her laptop. I don't seem to recall that that was a consideration. Remember when they went in and seized all of Michael Cohen's documents and computers, you know, Donald Trump's lawyer, they didn't worry about that at all. So that right there shows you how different they've treated these two investigations, just that sole thing.
But let's just stipulate for the purpose of discussion, Hans von Spakovsky, that they've treated the two differently. Is one more normal, though, than the other? Is one pretty much what we've been told, business as usual, or Are they both just sort of different extremes, but nonetheless departures from standard practice?
No, I think they're both departures from standard practice. I think they've been too tough, much harder than normal in the Russia investigation, and I think they were much softer in the Clinton investigation.
And curiously enough, it's the same people in most cases that are doing both, right? Which speaks to this question of political bias, I think.
Yeah. And look, another good example of this that just kind of is glossed over in the IG report is that, look, when the FBI goes in and interviews a witness, they don't allow other witnesses in the case to be in there listening to what that targeted witness is saying. And yet when they went in and interviewed Hillary Clinton, who wasn't just a potential witness, but a potential target, again, they allowed two of the other people who were witnesses and potential targets in the investigation, again, her two top aides, Huma Abedin and Cheryl Mills, to be in on the interview. That is extraordinary that they would allow that to happen.
Hans, let me switch gears if I can. There's a lot going on another of the fronts that you've focused to great effect upon, and that is the immigration issue. As we're speaking, the president is meeting with members of the House caucus. We don't know the outcome of that. We will by the time this program airs, of course. But I just wonder your general take on where we are. A man in the person of President Trump, who campaigned very aggressively on securing the border, the wall, of course, most famously, but also, reforming the immigration system so as to end the various sweetheart arrangements and other dubious practices like, a visa lottery, for example, that is just insane in terms of letting anybody in on the basis of a game of chance. Where are we now, as you see it, Hans, and what are the stakes in terms of what the House is expected to vote on in the next day or so?
Well, the main bill apparently that's leading in support is this bill that Paul Ryan put together. They call it a compromise bill. It's a terrible bill. It's one that will give amnesty to upwards of probably almost 2 million illegals in the country, and then maybe more because it only partially gets rid of chain migration. And doesn't do many of the other things that have got to be done to control the situation, the most obvious one of which is, look, the only way to diminish the huge population of illegals inside the country is to make it impossible for them to work. Because if they can't work, they can't earn money to support themselves and send remittances to their native countries, they're going to self-deport. And the only way to do that is to make, for example, the E-Verify system mandatory for employers so that they have to check with the federal government to make sure that when they hire somebody, they're not an illegal alien. That's nowhere to be found in either of the two bills that are being considered. So it's a bad deal that I think, unfortunately, people are pushing because they're afraid of this issue being around for the November congressional election.
And part of what's going on, as you know so well, Hans von Spakovsky, is the hyper-inflaming of this issue with the matter of the separation of children brought here by people entering the country illegally. There's a lot of distortion in the system about what exactly is going on here. Does the law require such a separation or not? What should be done to change the law in any event? Give us your quick take on that, if you would, please.
Well, the way to think about this is to compare it to what we do with ordinary crimes for ordinary American citizens. Look, if an American citizen is arrested for committing a crime like robbery, we don't refuse to arrest them and put them in jail and prosecute them because they have a minor child.
Hans, such important clarity. Thanks for the great work you do, my friend, these days at the Heritage Foundation. I do hope you'll visit with us again in the near future.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.